Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Roz Chast. Hello, Roz.
Hi.
Gee whiz, Roz. I've been admiring your work for years in The New Yorker, so this is the realization of a longtime dream. I'm sure many of our listeners have seen your work. Tell us what that is.
Well, I draw cartoons for The New Yorker magazine. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. I've been drawing cartoons for The New Yorker magazine since 1978. I guess that's it.
And you've put out a lot of books, but this new one is a lot different from the others.
Yes. Yes. I have done a number of collections of cartoons that have appeared mostly in The New Yorker and other magazines. And I've done some children's books. This is the first nonfiction memoir type book that I've done. And the title of the book is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And it's about my taking care of my parents, my mother and my father, who died at the ages of 95 and 97 in 2007 and 2009. And I was an only child, and so the job more or less fell to me. And this book is sort of about the last 10 years of their lives and about that, and a little bit about them and about some, you know, background about me and them.
Can't we talk about something more pleasant? The balloon is coming out of your dad's mouth. They were quite a pair, weren't they?
Oh, very much so. They were born in 1912, 10 days apart. And they were really characters. I mean, they were very admirable in a lot of ways, very eccentric, very devoted to each other. And that's kind of partly what the book's about.
And they called themselves soulmates, and this was very unironic, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. This was not, irony was not a part of any of this.
Okay, so we look at this, and so many people have gone through something like this with their parents, and this is usually a fairly unfunny subject, yet you managed to bring quite a bit of levity in it, even though it's pretty painful stuff.
Well, yeah, there were some funny aspects to it. Definitely.
Yeah. And, of course, you have that perspective that we enjoy so much in your other cartoons, where you can turn something that might seem mundane into something hysterically funny.
Well, you know, there were aspects of my parents' personalities that sort of I found funny. I don't know if they did so much, but I found it sort of funny.
Your mom, she was tough. She was, she had a little anger, didn't she?
Yeah, she had a temper. And
yeah.
I think she was one of those people that sort of, she really, you knew how she was feeling at any given time. You know, if something made her angry, she would let you know. You know, she'd let you have it. You know, she was very proud of it in a way. She would talk about, you know, giving somebody. She was an assistant principal, a job for which she was perfectly suited. She was a disciplinarian. She was very smart. She knew what she thought. She was very sure of her opinions. She didn't have that thing that I think my father and that I have where, you know, something comes up and you think, well, this is the right answer. And then somebody says, no, actually, you know, it's this. And then you go, yeah, you know, you're kind of right, too. And then a third person comes along and then you go, you know, you're kind of got a point, too. And then, you know, you have like 12 different opinions in your head that you're sort of like weighing and juggling. She wasn't like that. You know, she was right. Everybody else was wrong. The end.
Mm.
So she was a good person to have in a crisis.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, she was very strong, very, very strong person.
Roz Chast joins us. Her book is can't we talk about something more pleasant? So you were a little closer to your dad. Your dad was a little warmer, wasn't he?
I think he was gentler.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, probably somewhat warmer. And just I think the fact that he was less sure of himself made him just sort of a little easier to be with.
So your parents lived in the same apartment for all these years, and they were accumulators. They had all this stuff in their apartment, and they get into their 90s, and they're doing okay. But then your mom has some health problems, and this caused you to realize that neither of them was really okay, that your dad, as soon as your mom was in the hospital and they were separated, your dad started showing signs which you hadn't recognized before of kind of having some problems with his mind.
Yeah, I mean, you know, senile dementia, I think, is what it was diagnosed as. And I think, you know, with a lot of people who have that, as long as it's not, you know, completely taken over their minds, a lot of the symptoms can kind of be masked by them doing the same things over and over in the same place as, you know, he was able to do when he was living in the apartment. In the apartment with my mother, who, you know, she, her mind was fine. It was her body that was falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she made all the major decisions anyway, even when he didn't have senile dementia. So, but it was when she went into the hospital and the father was living with us for 2 weeks that it was, you know, much more obvious that he had, you know, senile dementia.
He was out of his comfort zone. And
yeah,
and
out of his comfort zone. He wouldn't remember where my mother was. He didn't know why he was living with us. He would ask me questions like, where do I live? And it was sort of sad. But, you know, it was sad. It was very, very sad. But there were some funny things in all of this. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that the kind of comedy I like is not, you know, sitcom comedy where, you know, people are sort of grinding out, and to me it always seems like they're grinding it out, like, you know, witty banter that never takes place in life, and it's like set up, punchline.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, I can admire the craft of it, but it's not really what makes me laugh. I mean, what makes me laugh is more, I love Louis C.K., I love, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm, where the comedy comes more out of, you know, a lot of different emotional situations. So, and, you know, then suddenly, like, something's funny.
Yeah, things like an obsession with where are the bank books?
The bank books, or, you know, taking my father shopping for clothes, you know, where, I mean, it was exactly how I had it in my book, where we were in the underwear department. His clothes were in tatters because, you know, he was in his 90s. They hadn't gone clothes shopping in a long time. And we went to the men's department of a local clothing store, and he hadn't seen the new style of advertisements where there are these, like, posters of bare-chested men, and they have been working out a lot, and they're hairless, and so they have these massive pecs.
Uh-huh.
And he had never seen this, and he just did this double take, and he said, what is that? And I said, what, Dad? And he goes, it looks like those men have breasts. and you know, I just made this mental note, like, this is kind of funny.
You have a description in there of going shopping with your mom, and, of course, this generation that lived through the Depression. They were always looking for a bargain. They never threw anything away. They wanted free stuff. They wanted cheap stuff. And
yeah.
I think you were looking at stockings, and your mother had these notions about...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she'd, like, take them out of the package. She'll sew them together. I mean, I grew up with, like, the slivers of soap, that she would save all the slivers of soap and sew them together. Like, she'd make a bag out of, like, an old washcloth and put all the slivers in the bag and then, like, sew up the top of the bag. You know, she made a bathrobe for herself out of old towels. I mean, you know, it's just very, it's really, it's that generation, and it's the Depression. And it's growing up poor.
Uh-huh.
You know, she had all these poems that she used to say, like, use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. You know, which is like, there were definitely aspects of this sort of thing that I think are very admirable, you know, rather than, I mean, now we get all these catalogs for, you know, these companies, and it's, you know, it's like, well, I'm just going to throw away this oven mitt because I'm bored with it, you know? I want to get another one. And then, like, 2 months later, I need, like, 14 oven mitts for, like, different seasons. I mean, you know, oh, it's spring. I think I'll change to my spring oven mitt. It's just bats. So it's like, you know, consumerism, you know, out of control. But, you know, my parents were the other extreme. It's like, we're going to make this oven mitt last until the end of time.
Well, it seems like a generational overreaction to all that frugality and the miserliness of that it caused, in a way.
Yeah. And, of course, all of this, you know, just lent this sort of black comedy to, you know, what happened at the end when they're in this place. And it's just, you know, phenomenal amounts of money.
Yeah.
And they don't even get to enjoy it.
Unbelievable.
When I
saw the amounts that they were charging, and there's all the extra costs, just, oh, obscene.
It is. And they know these places, these assisted living places, know that they've kind of got you, you know? I mean, what are you going to say? No.
Yeah.
I want to put my parents in a cheaper, crappier place.
and they know. They've worked all their lives, and they've been frugal, and they've saved all this money at the scrimping bank or whatever you call
it.
Yeah. And your dad spoke Yiddish and Italian, and
yeah, lots of languages.
I don't know Yiddish, but I love so many words that I hear in Yiddish. What scrimp? Is that a Yiddish word?
No, it should be, but it's not. It's not. It's scrimping is a regular English word.
Okay, I love that word.
It's a good word, isn't it?
And they were scrimpers.
They were really scrimpers. Scrimpers and savers, yeah. Yeah.
So you had moved off to Connecticut. You were raising a family. You hadn't been back in Brooklyn for a long time.
Yeah.
And then you decided you better start going back and seeing your folks. And this was sort of the beginning of the book where you start reconnecting with them in a way, and they've gotten old. And then you deal with all these things. And finally, when they're gone, you have to deal with that apartment full of stuff.
Yeah. And, I mean, I didn't deal that much with it. I dealt with it some. And my husband and I went out to Brooklyn a couple of times, and I went out a few times by myself, and then at a certain point, it was so beyond what I felt, just time-wise and emotionally sort of capable of, I just paid the super to empty it, you know, and I just said, take whatever you want. I mean, throw it out the window. I don't care. I wanted the photo albums.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a few other things, you know, I think I list them in the book. But most of it didn't really mean that much to me. And also, it's just more stuff. It's you start to look at it, like I look at my own stuff now and I think, you know, this is stuff. And now my kids are going to have to throw this stuff out. And it's a little... you know, you start to look at your stuff differently.
The nightmare of too much stuff.
Stuff, you know,
stuff.
Like old pots and pans that, you know, are really old. And, you know, the drawer that I have some photos in the book, the drawer of jar lids. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I'm not talking about really cool stuff, just stuff, objects, stuff. You know?
Stuff they couldn't throw away. We're going to find a use for this someday.
Yeah, someday I'll need this rusty jar lid.
Right.
Like someday when I think I want tetanus.
Roz Chess joins us. Her memoir is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Oh, yeah, sure. Let's talk about grime. grime. They didn't have a very grimy apartment years before, but as they got older, it became harder to keep the place clean, didn't it?
Yeah. I think you sort of run out of steam. I mean, I can feel myself sort of like running out of steam, so I can't imagine what it's like to be 90. You know, I think you just kind of let a lot of stuff go.
Yeah. And your mom outlived your dad.
Yes.
By a couple of years.
Yeah, just 2 years, yeah.
And this is a very personal thing. You have pictures in here that you drew of your mom during her last days. These are not cartoons.
Right.
Very powerful to see those.
Yeah, that was the last few months, last July, August, September, and then she died at the end of September.
And I think this is a wonderful tribute to them, but I have to think it was difficult for you to do this, to decide to make this public.
It's kind of what I do, you know? I mean, I feel like it's something I wanted to talk about a little bit and find out, you know, are other people thinking about this? You know, have other people gone through this? And evidently, a lot of people have. And I don't know. I mean, I draw cartoons, and they're in public. You know, that's what I meant when I said that's what I do. I mean, I don't draw cartoons in a sketchbook and, you know, put them away. They're kind of out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a really different kind of book than I've ever done before, but my cartoons aren't in a diary. They're in a magazine that everybody reads. Not everybody, but everybody who reads the magazine sees cartoons, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sees, you know, if you subscribe, what am I saying? So inarticulately. If you subscribe to The New Yorker, then you're seeing my cartoons.
Uh-huh.
So what I do, you know, I draw cartoons and people see them. So in a way, this is what I do. You know, I write about stuff and I draw about stuff. I just haven't done this before and probably won't again.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Maybe I will. I have no idea.
I love this picture. When you've included a number of photographs, but they're very selective. And you have this one when your dad dies.
Yeah.
And it just says George Chest. And you're standing there. You look very young. And he's leaning down and he's smiling. This is a wonderful photo.
I love that photo too. Yeah, he was a real sweet guy, you know. He was a good guy.
Yeah. So when you were a little girl, when you were that age, did you think, I want to be a cartoonist when I grow up? How did this happen?
How did this happen? it was a very gradual, no, I feel like, how did you get to weigh like 700 pounds? It was, how did this happen? I always liked to draw,
uh-huh.
You know, I think all little kids, I mean, I have two kids who are grown now, but both of them, when they were very little, before they wrote, they always, you know, picked up a crayon and, you know, their little baby fists, and they just kind of made marks on paper. It seems like a very basic urge to draw. And I guess, you know, for me, it was something that I just kept doing.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad you did. And I think that your publisher, Bloomsbury, did just a fabulous job on this book.
Totally agree. I'm, you know, very indebted to my publisher and also my wonderful editor, who was just great and very encouraging and, you know, the right kind of editor that can kind of help you with things where you need help and not just, you know, randomly do stuff or try to do stuff.
What kind of stuff do you need help with?
Well, like when you turn in a manuscript, sometimes I repeated myself, and I didn't mean to. It's just like I told a story in one chapter, and then I told it again in another chapter. And she would say, I think it works better over here than it did over there.
Hmm.
you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. I'm a New Yorker subscriber. I think if you looked at the demographics, you'd see a lot of crossover between NPR listeners and New Yorker subscribers. So I'm sure we have a lot of listeners out there who are familiar with your work. I've been talking to writers and various other artists on this program for about 20 years. Over the years, I've had people on who I associate with the New Yorker, Ian Fraser, Garrison Keillor.
Oh, yeah, I know him. He's great. He's
Calvin Trillin, Victoria Roberts, Brendan Gill. I've had them all on the show. What a special thing. What a special magazine. How did you get the gig at the New Yorker? I mean, how did this happen?
In 1978, I was selling cartoons to a couple of places. I graduated from art school in 77, RISD, and I was taking my cartoons around, and I called up. I had sold some to the National Lampoon and the Village Voice, a couple of other places, and I called up the New Yorker offices and found out when cartoonists dropped their stuff off, you know, over the transom stuff. I didn't know anybody there. And they said on Wednesday, so I brought my portfolio full of cartoons. I really had no idea how many or, you know, what the procedure was, but I just kind of guessed. And then I went to pick it up the next week. I really did not think I would be working for The New Yorker. I mean, my parents subscribed, so I was familiar with it. But at the time, my stuff looked so different. I thought maybe if I'm lucky, I'll wind up working for The Village Voice. So I came in the next week to pick up my portfolio, and there was a note from Lee Lorenz, who was the art editor then, and he said to come back and see him. So I did, and they bought a cartoon. I was, you know, flabbergasted. It does not begin to describe it. And he told me to start coming back every week, so I did.
Wow. Well, I know how tough that is. I've heard about all the rejection people have experienced.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah, not just with cartoons. I mean, with everything, poetry, stories. And there's so many iconic figures that we associate with that publication. Joseph Mitchell, James Thurber, the list just goes on and on. And I remember when we had Brendan Gill, the late Brendan Gill, on the program, he described going to the memorial service for probably one of my favorite cartoonists from the period, and that was Charles Adams.
Oh, boy, yeah. Wow.
I hear that was an amazing thing they had it at the library. Did you hear about that?
No, no.
Oh, Brendan, he could tell a story.
I believe it. Well, what did he say? Now I'm curious.
Well, apparently Charles had quite an opulent bar set up. And Brendan, he seemed to like it when Cy Newhouse put up opulent food and drinks, and Brendan certainly noted that Adams was quite generous in his bequest to his mourners.
That's great. That's actually terrific.
Yeah, it was a great story.
Yeah.
The book is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Roz Chess joins us on the program. Did you start drawing these cartoons while they were still alive?
Some of them, yeah. I mean, I guess maybe you've heard from some of the other cartoonists. We submit groups of cartoons every week.
Uh-huh.
So some of the things, like the Oven Mitt cartoon and a few others, the Dirty Checkers one, were things that I just had done. The one about the Beetle Crusher's shoes, the
uh-huh.
rare sex talk. Some of them I had done in the, you know, not thinking about them being in any kind of book or, you know, book like this. But I included them because they were about my parents. You know, they were sort of specific about conversations I'd had with my parents. So some of them I had done years before, and some of them came from, you know, stuff that was going on at the time. It was different things.
So they were inspired by your parents, but I'm guessing that they probably weren't aware of it.
No, they didn't know about the Dirty Checkers cartoon because it was never published anywhere.
I see. Okay.
You know, it was in my pile of rejects.
I getcha.
Yeah. So, but that was, you know, I mean, my father really did. We were in the living room in my house, and it was on one of the visits. My parents were visiting me, and he looks at the fireplace, and he suddenly starts telling me about this Nathaniel Hawthorne short story. I think it's called The Ambitious Guest. And this it's during a snowstorm, and all the guests at this inn are sitting around. I might be butchering this, but all the guests at this inn are sitting around a fireplace. And the guest starts telling everybody, like, plans for his future. And people start talking about their plans for the future. And then, boom, an avalanche comes down and kills them all. I mean, that's, you know, and it's like, Dad, you know, why, you know, you just associated this fireplace, this very nice fireplace, to this, like, avalanche story. I don't know. It's just, it's kind of funny. It is funny, really. You have to think of it that way.
Well, I was hopeful that I could get an interview with you because I read that piece about you in the New York Times the other day, and I thought, maybe I can get an interview with Roz Chast. I'm going to try it. I love that piece in the Times.
Yeah, the home section one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was funny. I don't know why they took a picture of my shed. I really do not know what's in it. I don't like the backyard. I'm not a big fan of the outdoors that much. Although, it's, you know, it's nice. It's very pretty right now. But, there's things, you know.
Well, it also gave us a hint about the final destination of your parents in the closet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, this is true.
And that was pretty amazing. I like that. It's low key.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't really have a better place for them yet. And I might at some point.
Yeah.
But we don't have a family plot.
Uh-huh.
And I like right now having them close to me.
Uh-huh.
And it's not like, you know, they're moldering away or something. I mean, it's, you know, some people have urns and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I don't like that so much.
Yeah. Well, it's really been great to have you on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Roz Chast. Her memoir is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. I really enjoyed talking to Roz Chast about her new graphic memoir. What a powerful story. We're going to do a quick pivot. Next week, we're going to have a crime novel for you. Craig Johnson wrote it. He created a character named Sheriff Longmire. He's got a beat out in Wyoming. And in this one, Walt Longmire is trying to solve the mystery of the disappearance of three women in a remote county in Wyoming. We'll be talking to Craig Johnson about his latest novel, Any Other Name, and Sheriff Walt Longmire in the Book Nook next week. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.